The views expressed in this program are those of the participants.
Open the doors! Let the outsiders in! How you doing, tough guy?
Are they getting enough food? They don't look too healthy.
If they were too healthy, they'd be a worse pain than they already are.
It gives you the right to treat them like this.
I give me the right. Look, around here there's only three roles you can play. You can be a wolf, you can be a sheep, or you can be a corpse.
Welcome, everyone. It is Wednesday, March 27th, 2024. I'm Bob Metz.
And I'm Robert Vaughn.
And this is Just Right, broadcasting around the world and online.
Join us for an hour of discussion that's not right wing, it's just right.
Fade into color, color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be alright.
Originally posted to our video channels on March 18th, Robert's full conversation with Salim Mansour was much longer than the time available in our limited weekly audio format. And I have to confess, it was a frustrating experience to condense that conversation into today's presentation. From the 19th century Pale Settlement to the writings of Theodor Herzl, the founder of modern Zionism, to the ongoing conflict in the Gaza Strip, they delved into the significance of Zionism's history and the establishment of Israel. The events that are currently transpiring in the Mideast may seem remote and distant to many, but history has repeatedly demonstrated the consequence of ignoring significant events abroad. And let me warn you in advance, Salim is arguing that there is no legal standing of the Balfour Declaration which created the State of Israel. And he cites the specific history that demonstrates this conclusion, which on its own is rather difficult to refute. But whether that history, or quote-unquote illegal status, if you will, has any bearing on Israel's immediate and long-term future is something that has yet to be determined. And as is our custom, throughout the course of today's show, via our selected audio bites, we'll be hearing some very differing perspectives that are bound to anger and offend some as well as to please others. It all begins right after our reminder that you can write us at feedback@justrightmedia.org. Hear us on WBCQ Shortwave. Follow and like us on your favorite podcast platform and visit us at justrightmedia.org, where you can access all of our social media links, archive broadcasts, and the support button that makes it easy for you to support the show. Because as always, your financial support is appreciated and is what makes this show possible.
Professor Salim Mansour joins me once again to discuss the ongoing conflict in the Middle East. Salim, your recent Substack article titled Falsus in Uno, Falsus in Omnibus brought to light several notable, yet overlooked, facts about the establishment of the State of Israel. One such gem was a quote from Theodor Herzl, the founder of modern Zionism, whose writings in 1896 motivated European Jews to colonize Palestine. And the quote that struck me and yourself from the article and from his pamphlet goes like this, and I'll just read it so that we can get a good sense of it here. Quoting Herzl, "If we wish to found a state today, we shall not do it in the way which would have been the only possible one 1,000 years ago. It is foolish to revert to old stages of civilization, as many Zionists would like to do. Supposing, for example, we were obliged to clear a country of wild beasts, we should not set about the task in the fashion of Europeans of the 5th century. We should not take spear and lance and go out singly in pursuit of bears. We would organize a large and active hunting party, drive the animals together, and throw a Melanite bomb into their midst." Now, at the time when he penned that in 1896, the decision to colonize Palestine was still to be determined. I mean, Argentina was also on the list. And of course, you have to put it in the context of the world events of 1896 and the Zionist movement and Herzl's own background. Nowhere in his book does he mention Arabs. He mentions Christians and Palestine, but he never mentions Arabs, which I think is telling. It's almost as if they're persona non grata, right? Or race non grata without any status. Now, that being said, though, do you take this attitude of Herzl as portrayed in that one quote to be shared or to be an exemplar of today's Zionists who wish to flout the United Nations, flout the global community by occupying the West Bank and driving the Arabs out of Gaza?
Yes, I mean, that quote, it is about emptying the land. The reference to bears are the reference to the people. So the people on the land are bears. Why not call them who they are, whatever ethnicity that Herzl imagines they are? He doesn't call them because this is the age in which he's writing, the high noon of European imperialism, in which the continents outside of Europe, particularly Africa, is a dark continent. People very close to being beasts or are beasts. And going into the dark continent is traveling into the heart of darkness, as in Joseph Conrad's famous little novella. So this is the language that Herzl is using. That how are we going to empty the land? You read the quote that I have in my paper, but that quote I have in my paper follows what is the plan? And the plan is that Herzl is saying, let the sovereignty be granted us over a portion of the globe large enough to satisfy the rightful requirements of a nation. The rest we shall manage for ourselves. In other words, he is making a plea to the European great powers. The Zionists are nobodies. Except there's few scattered individuals like Herzl.
He also mentions in his same book, Salim, he compares the colonizing by Jews of an area, whether it's Argentina or Palestine or Uganda, to a civilizing force versus the existent barbarians.
That's
He
right.
mentions that, civilization versus barbarians.
European Jews, according to Herzl, pose a problem to the European powers. And together, we, the European Jews, and the European powers can solve the problem of Europe. You, European powers, give us or grant us a portion of the globe, and we will manage it. We
He's
will.
playing on their anti-Semitism. He's saying, okay, you don't want us here. There's a
Yeah.
Jewish problem, a Jewish question. Well,
Yeah.
if you don't like us here, then send us elsewhere.
Yeah, just grant us a land and send us elsewhere. We will get out. You will solve your problem. We will have a state. That's the scam. Because by themselves, the Jews are European. They're assimilated or they're living in the Pale, Eastern Europe.
They don't know what to do with Hezbollah. They don't know what to do with Hamas. The total budget of those guys is nothing comparing with the military budget of Israel. And Israel cannot win this war. Americans are not willing to fight for Israelis, but they cannot allow themselves not to fight for Israelis, because in any other case scenario, Israelis will create hell for Biden on his ground, on his soil, through mass media that sympathize Israelis. And that's a huge problem.
Israel, I'm not anti-Semitic. I know Israel's a diverse group of people. I'm not against Israel, but you have Israel stand down on October 7th, and then you have them now carpet bombing and doing all of this and genociding people, and it turns the whole world against them. And the Israeli spokesman said 2 days ago, we don't care if the whole world turns against us. Well, they already have. You're Jewish. I'm asking you, what do you think the calculus is in all of this for what Israel's doing?
Well, that's one of the hardest questions, and I had to explain my friends in Russia. Not Israelis, not all Israelis are Jewish, and not all Jews are Israelis. As far as I'm concerned, it doesn't matter what religion, what color, or what nationality is the kid that is killed. You cannot allow yourself to kill women and children. That is wrong. And when Israelis saying that, oh, the whole nation should be wiped off, that's our sacred war, it's insane. We cannot do the same thing to Palestinians as Nazis were doing to us during the Second World War. That is not our way.
Exactly. So why is Israel losing that? Why are they purposely destroying the high ground?
I think that it's done by Bibi, who is fighting his own political future. And that's why there are a lot of people in Israel that are saying that, come on, guys, what are we doing? How did we get there? And that's why there are a lot of people inside Israel that, of course, and one thing for sure, the terrorist attack against Israelis was awful, devastating act of terrorism. And every single terrorist should be destroyed. But terrorists,
but they should
not
show
women
restraint.
And kids.
They should show restraint like Putin.
Exactly. If you want to kill all the terrorists, why do you have to destroy whatever is around and not destroy the terrorists? You wanted to free hostages. Where are the hostages? Why they're not with the families? How come that you put the main goal, I will come and free every single hostage? You didn't. I will go and kill all the Hamas. You didn't. You killed women. He killed kids, maybe a few Hamas fighters, but Hamas is still there. But what you actually completely destroyed is support for Jewish people around the world.
And that is devastating. I totally agree, because I'm not anti-Israel. I see Israel destroying itself. I'm being accused of being anti-Israel. I don't believe Israel should be destroyed. They have nuclear weapons. Even though I hated Israel, which I don't, they're not going to go away unless there's a nuclear war. It's another trigger that threatens us all.
It's been a bad year for poor people inadvertently occupying desirable beachfront property. It would appear that acquisitive eyes have recently turned towards Gaza, where the rubble of Palestinian homes rests on valuable real estate, overlooking the sapphire blue waters of the Mediterranean Sea. US President Joe Biden's proposed port construction on the coast there, ostensibly to enable delivery of humanitarian aid, will apparently be built in part with that rubble. Rubble salted with the bones of Gazan men, women and children, tens of thousands of them killed so far in the war described as plausible genocide by the International Court of Justice. Any of it might be bulldozed into the sea as foundations for that new harbour, giving convenient access to that open-air prison. That's some monument in prospect, buried at sea. At a special meeting of the Knesset Foreign Affairs and Defence Committee, Benjamin Netanyahu is reported to have said that that port can facilitate the exit of Palestinians from Gaza. So the military operations in Gaza are either about making war on terror or preparing the ground for brownfield development, or perhaps both, who could say? Gaza has been inhabited for thousands of years. President Joe Biden and his rival Donald Trump are both older, however, than the modern state of Israel. But that's just a detail of the unimaginably long timeline of that ancient, tortured landscape. In any event, in the modern world, everything of note is just business. Jared Kushner, son-in-law of President Donald J. Trump and sometime senior policy advisor to that president on matters Middle Eastern, spoke at Harvard University in February. Quote, Gaza's waterfront property could be very valuable. Kushner lamented the money spent building the tunnels under Gaza and said it could have been better used instead for education and innovation. Quote, it's a little bit of an unfortunate situation there, but from Israel's perspective, I would do my best to move the people out and clean it up. He said he didn't think Israel had publicly stated it didn't want the locals to move back towards their former homes, but... He said that if he was in charge of Israel, his number one priority would be moving Gazans out of the southern city of Rafah, and that it might be possible to shovel those displaced souls, already displaced more often in one lifetime than a person might count, onto a spot somewhere in the Negev desert in southern Israel. Quote, I would just bulldoze something in the Negev, he said. I would try to move the people in there. I think that's the better option, so you can go in and finish the job. I'm not picking on Kushner particularly. He just happened to be recorded speaking the truth out loud. What he said at Harvard is what many others think anyway. Clear out the Gaza Strip, ready for something else, someone else. Business is business, and in the property business, as we have learned to say, it's all about location, location, location.
Herzl was born in 1860, about the middle of the 19th century. Europe has gone through upheavals since the French Revolution. Empires are being transformed into nation states, and nation states are coming around. This is the age of European nationalism. And as he enters into young adulthood, the nationalist forces are engaged both in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, in former part of the Holy Roman Empire, which is Italy, in Germany, and the one which captivates the mind of most people in Europe at that time, the contemporaries of Herzl, is the Risorgimento, the rebirth of the Italian nation, Garibaldi and Mazzini leading the campaign to unite Italy into a nation state. So it's all happening in front of Herzl. Herzl is born in 1860 in Budapest, Hungary, part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, to parents who are well-to-do parents. His father, Jacob Herzl, is a banker and a businessman, a very successful banker and businessman in Budapest. His wife, Janet Herzl's mother, is an assimilated US, leaning towards Germany, fascinated with German culture and German history. The large bulk of Central European Jews are being Germanized, and they move from Budapest to the capital, Vienna, which is where Herzl then later on goes to university. So all around him, there are things in motion philosophically, things in motion economically, things in motion in terms of science and engineering and development taking places. But most importantly, Europe is the seat of empires. And these empires are no longer simply limited to Europe. They are global in nature. The British Empire, by the time Herzl is a young man, the British have conquered India. And Britain has become an empire in which the crown head of Britain, Queen Victoria, she is the empress now. She's declared an empress. She's no longer the Queen of England. She is the Queen of England, but she is the empress also, you know. So this is the age of empire, the high noon, as I say, of European imperialism. Within this, eruptions that are taking place, massive changes that are taking place in Europe, Herzl comes around and talks about anti-Semitism, the Jewish problem. But Herzl is not alone. There are others who have been talking about the Jewish problem. Very famously, Marx has talked about Jewish problem. Karl Marx is one of his famous essays called The Jewish Question. Others have talked about it, the Jewish problem. The question is about assimilation. The question is about secular Europe. Secularization is taking place, the separation of religion and state. All of these things are happening at the same time. And Herzl is in the midst of it. Herzl grows up as an assimilated Jew. What does that mean? You know, he's simply culturally a Jew, a nominally a Jew. He's not a practicing Jew. His parents are not practicing Jew. They're not religious Jews. And in fact, Herzl, as a young man, he becomes an atheist. So where does this whole notion of his Jewishness comes around? That, again, is another fascinating story in history. The famous Dreyfus case, Alfred Dreyfus. Alfred Dreyfus was a captain in the French army. This is after the Franco-Prussian War of 1870. And Herzl, as a young man, has arrived in Paris for an Austrian paper to report on European affairs, the affair that turns out to be the one which captures the imagination of the French people is the Dreyfus trial. And Dreyfus being a Jew, this became scandalous that here was a Jewish officer in the French army who is a traitor to the French nation, to the French country, to the French Grand Army. But nothing has been proven. So reporting the case, finally the court finds Dreyfus guilty and sends him away for a life imprisonment and deports him. And Herzl is, among others, outraged at what has happened. And this is his moment of epiphany that Here they go around and indict a man because of his religious background and who he is and call him a traitor. This is the moment that leads Herzl to rethink what has been discussed among a certain elements of Jewish intellectuals in terms of the Jewish problem. And he comes up with his book, The Jewish State.
Now, could it be possible, Salim, that when he's talking about clearing the land of beers, and he does say beers, he doesn't say Arabs, he doesn't say Argentinians. Now, wherever he goes, obviously there's going to be people there.
Right.
Although he's talking about the vast tracts of land in Argentina, which are not highly populated. They're sparsely populated. As a matter of fact, some of them are still to be tamed. So could it possibly be that Herzl was actually speaking literally? Could he have literally been talking about wild animals rather than people?
Well, it could be, but you don't empty the land of wild animals or animals. You empty the land of people if you're going to colonize it, if particularly if it is a colonial movement, a settler colonial movement based on ethno-nationalism. The Jewish state is for the Jews only, exclusively for the Jews, right? Because the Jews, whatever number they are in Europe, is barely 1.1, 1.2% of the European population at that time. And the majority of the Jews are still in Eastern Europe, just the Pale of Settlement. That's the western part of Russia, the Baltic states, and Poland that constitute the Pale of Settlement, where the Jews have been confined, sort of, and where they exist. So the largest number of Jews are in the Pale of Settlement, and then the Jews in Western Europe, in Austria, Hungary, in Germany, in Netherlands, and in England and France. Remember, the Jews had been expelled from Spain at the end of 15th century, just as the Arabs were expelled after 1492, the reconquest of Spain. The Jews had been expelled from England in 1290. The Jews only returned to England after Oliver Cromwell in the 17th century. They were expelled in the 13th century, and they returned when the ban on the Jews were lifted. So there have been expulsions, and then there have been return. But we are now in the 19th century, in the age of nationalism, in the age of secularization, and so on. And what Herzl, in his book, is laying out is the demand for a Jewish state. There it is. The title of the book is The Jewish State, you know. So the Jews who are in the Western half of Europe, they are assimilating into the European state. They are French Jews, English Jews, and Dutch Jews, German Jews, and Austrian Jews. Then there are the Jews in the Pale of Settlement, and predominantly the Jews of the Pale of Settlement are religious Jews, Orthodox Jews, because they're the Jews living in ghettos. They're not emancipated to come out and live in the common population. Herzl's demand is for a Jewish state. This whole notion comes around as a result of the Dreyfus case. The Jews are not even secure in France. That is his argument, you know. And so he's asking, so you have a problem? Well, we'll solve your problem together. You have a problem, you help us, find us a piece of land, a portion of the globe, and we will move there and we'll create, we'll not create any state, we'll create the Jewish state. So what about the people who are non-Jews over there? That is the Gentiles, the Goyim, the beasts. Well, we're going to empty the land. The Jewish state is an exclusive state. A Catholic state would be an exclusive state.
He does talk about Christians. Now, he's really pushing the Palestine argument. He said that that would be the preferable of the two because of the motivational element, because of the history of the area and Judaism. However, I mean, let me just quote you another couple of quotes which might go against that argument that he's going to clear the land. He says, and I'm quoting, "We shall not occupy the territories by force, but we shall establish a state by legal methods. We shall purchase the needful land at a reasonable price." And again, Herzl, in another chapter, the following chapter, says, "Each man will be as free and undisturbed in his faith or his disbelief as he is in his own nationality. And if it should occur that men of other creeds and different nationalities come to live amongst us, we should accord them honorable protection and equality before the law. And he goes further by saying that in particular in Palestine, he would make those areas predominantly Christian, ex-territorial, and guard them, give them a place of honor outside of the territory of Israel and make sure that they're not molested. Again, it's a sort of a insinuating an Arab revolt without saying it. But these comments from Herzl sort of belie the notion that he wants to clear the land of anybody who is not Jewish. What motivates me and interests me and you are getting into the mind of the man and the motivations based on religion, anti-Semitism, ethnicity, things of that nature are very fascinating.
You're right. Why anyone should look at Herzl and Herzl's book is to look at the origin of the idea of where we have arrived at. I mean, all that the argument that is going on right now as a consequence of where the state of Israel has arrived, that it is engaged in plausible genocide, if not genocide itself. The argument is also that this is nothing new, that in fact, ethnic cleansing, which is part of the continuum that leads to genocide or is genocide, has been going on since the beginning of last century, that is, after the end of World War I and the imposition of the Balfour Declaration into the Palestine Mandate. Okay. So to understand all of that, at least you got to look at the architect of this idea and then flush out the history.
Ben-Gurion, when he declared in 1948 on Rothschild Boulevard, by the way, that Israel was independent, if you look behind him, there's a portrait of Theodore Herzl behind him. He is the Karl Marx. He is, you know, the driving force behind the creation state of Israel, and his acknowledgement by having a portrait of him hanging behind Ben-Gurion as he declares independence is not gone unnoticed.
No, you ask any Israeli, the father of the nation state of Israel is Herzl. So it is not something that you or I or anyone else is imposing. It is a fact. Herzl is the George Washington or Simon Bolivar or Garibaldi of the Jewish state. His book is The Jewish State. He is the first man who proposes that. He is the man who organizes the World Zionist Organization and starts off the conferences. The first conference was in Basel, Switzerland in 1897, and then series of conferences take place. That's the organization whose founder is Herzl that leads on to the making of the state of Israel through the Balfour Declaration.
All I'm saying, Salim, is that he seems to be a man of contradiction if, on the one hand, we get a glimpse that, first of all, he doesn't mention Arabs, even though he wants to be in Palestine, doesn't mention them at all. And then there's this passage about clearing the land by corralling the beasts and throwing in a Melanite bomb. But then the contradictory arguments is like, we're not going to use force and anybody who has a different religion can live amongst us in peace. Could this be an example of that old adage? And you know Shakespeare, you've acted Shakespeare, you're a scholar of Shakespeare. The devil can cite scripture for his purpose. You know, yeah. Taken from The Merchant of Venice, as you might realize, you know. We pick and choose segments to further our own cause. So might be a little disingenuous to single out that thing, that quote about clearing the land with a Melanite bomb and suggesting that we forget the rest of it.
My critics are going to say that, you know, the Zionists are going to say that to the responses. Well, what is Ms. Bibi Netanyahu and others doing right now?
They're clearing the land with Melanite bombs.
Exactly. But the more relevant fact, apart from that sort of backhanded criticism, the quote is from that section of his book called The Plan. The title of the chapter is The Plan. And what is the plan? The plan is to the European powers, give us sovereignty over a portion of the globe, and we will do the rest. There's a list of what is the rest he is going to do or his organization is going to do. Right at the top of the list of things that he's going to do is clear the land by throwing Melanite bombs. Then among the list are the other things that he would do. We are going to create a state that will be some sort of a democratic state, that there will be freedom and so on and so forth. Okay, so there's a whole thing. And then you see on the economic side, he's looking for money so that he can buy land wherever the imperial powers help him locate a portion of the globe. All of these are from his book. But then the critical fact is that he dies in 1904. He leaves behind a World Zionist organization with a blueprint, that is, to get a land in Palestine.
And it worked out, I mean, for the Israelis.
Oh, you guys don't know about this? So after the Holocaust, there was a movement started by a man named Theodor Herzl to find a Jewish state. That movement is called Zionism.
That was a lot before.
Yeah,
that
was a lot before. Long before.
It started in the 19th century.
Yeah, fuck you then. Nerds. Theodor Herzl, he wanted Jews to have a state. And that idea is called Zionism. That word has been reframed. It's being used now to describe people who support occupation and are racist towards Arabs. That is not what it means at all.
Welcome back to the Neil Oliver Show. Now, I'm lucky enough this week to have my guest, George Galloway, MP. So let's turn our attention to the situation in the Middle East. You said that what happened in Rochdale, your attention on Rochdale was for Gaza. Can you tell me what you mean and meant by that?
Well, the people who oppose the murderous war in Gaza, which has reached the stage that the highest court in the world has said that it can plausibly be described as a genocide, pretty strong and heavy charge, which the highest court in the world has sent Israel for trial on, is so horrific to so many millions of people in this country and indeed around the world, that it is a wonder that they are locked out of media and parliamentary opinion. No one speaks for the people out on the streets from Land's End to John O'Groats every other Saturday and midweeks and rain, hail, snow. Nobody speaks for them in Parliament. They don't get a look in the legacy media on the television. If they are interviewed, as you're interviewing me now, they're called divisive or demagogic, because they want to stop children being killed, slaughtered every day and night of the last 150 days. So there's something of a conspiracy against the voices for peace, for ceasefire, for withdrawal from this war. And then a by-election came along. And what better place to fight, to break the silence, to break the mold, than a parliamentary by-election where there are the best part of 1.5 million or 2 million people who oppose this war. So it became a greater Manchester cause celebre, and the rest is history. We beat the legacy political parties out the park.
George, Tom, someone does have to speak up for Gaza and the Gazans. You know, you say, you use the word demagogue, you use the word divisive, but surely it is true to say that with 30,000 dead, 100,000 people in total dead or wounded or lost in the rubble, someone is right to speak up for Gaza.
And I accept George Galloway can speak up for whoever he likes. He's now an elected Member of Parliament. But with that comes a lot of responsibility. It comes, for example, not just for the constituents of Rochdale, but in terms of taking part in our national debate, that we don't further tensions, sectarianism, or indeed promote the idea that we should be even electing factions based on religious grounds to Parliament.
How about that, George? I think we would both concede that the Britain that you and I grew up in has radically changed in a very brief space of time. I think it's been more changed and changed more quickly than perhaps any other country, possibly ever. Do you understand, sympathise with the anxieties, the angers, the despair that's there in many communities around the country in the face of change?
That much is undoubtedly true, but I really must deal with this divisive issue. You can't sit on the fence on the plausible genocide in Gaza. You're either for it or you're against it. If you're against it, you must speak against it. You must march against it. You must protest about it. And you must call out the people proselytizing for it. Now, if that is divisive, well, what else can one do? Can we try and find a cozy consensus? Maybe we'll kill just people over the age of 45. Maybe we'll only starve those who are already overweight. I mean, what's the consensus, the non-divisive approach to this? Children are being killed. I'm against it. I spoke out against it. The people endorsed my stance. And that's really all there is to it. I have no responsibility to your guest to keep my criticism of a genocide within bounds that please him, even if I were able to divine what those bounds might be. But yes, there's always been division in politics, Neil. The 60s were divisive. The 70s, even more divisive. And they didn't require me in Parliament. Look, politics is divisive. Do you go this way or do you go that way? And let the schools of thought contend and let the people choose between them. That's my view.
You are listening to Just Right, broadcasting around the world and online.
Your article, one of the things that I picked out, which intrigued me, was the King Crane Report. It's suppression by the Americans. It was an official government commission designed to find out the sentiment of the people living in Palestine at the moment before Israel to see what they wanted. Can you tell us about the King Crane Report?
The commission was made up of two principal delegates. And they were Henry King, who was a president of Oberlin College in Ohio. And the other person was Charles R. Crane, also closely associated with the president, but he was a businessman. And so these two men were nominated to take the mission, the King Crane Mission Commission, on a open hearing of what the people of the Turkish Empire, the Arab people of the Turkish Empire, that is the Middle East, what do they want? What do they say? Okay. And so that commission was preparing its report by going traveling through, calling for open hearings, having open hearings in places like Damascus, in Haifa, in Jaffa, in Jerusalem, Aleppo, and so on and so forth. And they came back and they were going to present the commission report at the end of August, and they did. The official King Crane Commission report was released at the end of August, 28 August 1919, if my memory serves me. I cite that commission report and I cite what is in that commission report. And the long and the short of it is the commission says to reject the whole idea of the Balfour Declaration because overwhelmingly the people in the region is against the idea of establishing a Jewish state under the Balfour Declaration in Palestine. And then King and Crane listed a whole number of reasons. And among them, he said, look, we spoke to the British Army, we spoke to the officers, the generals, the colonels, and everyone unanimously agreed that this project cannot be fulfilled without a huge standing army. Well, how many men would you need? The commission asked. Well, we would need in excess of 50,000 men. That's a several division. A war has ended in which the very blossom of the European youth have been massacred. And now they're going to send 50,000 British and French or maybe American soldiers into Palestine. They said, no, this shouldn't happen. You know, what about the religious argument? Well, the religious argument was the Jews would be the least acceptable to both the Christians and the Muslims to manage holy sites, the sacred places in Palestine, to all three religions. Because, and there I quoted them, the sites that are sacred to the Christians are an abomination to the Jews. The sites which are sacred to the Christians are also sacred to the Muslims. And therefore, through the history, the Muslims have been the guardians, because the Muslims treat all the sites of Jews and Christians and Muslims as sacred. To give it to the Jews would create a huge problem.
What struck me was the disparity in population between the indigenous, if you want to use that word, Jews,
right,
in the area in question, right, and the population relative to that of Arabs. Can you tell us what that was?
The census figure that they had, I mean, the ones that I cited to you, came from both the English sources and the census that were taken during the Turkish Empire. So at the time the war happened, that is the period 1914-1918, the last credible figures that were available in Palestine itself was 700,000 Arab Palestinians. It didn't break it down into Christian and Jews, but a majority would be Muslims. And the Jewish population was somewhere around 65,000. So it was one-tenth or less of Jewish population in Palestine, in contrast to the Arab population, Christians and Muslims. Then further refinement or opinion of that population on the Arab-Palestinian side, Arab Christians and Muslims, there was a unanimity of rejecting the idea of the Balfour Declaration. But on the Jewish side, it was a minority opinion, because the majority of the Jews in Palestine who had arrived there during the Turkish Empire from the Pale of Settlement were religious Jews, and they had nothing to do with Zionism. As I pointed out, Zionism was barely supported by 1% of the Jewish population in Europe, European Jews. No, it was not something that had any substantive support. 1% is totally negligible. And that same 1% or less was the view of the Jews in Palestine. So the Crane Commission report did the factual study of the situation by visiting Palestine after the war and taking the time to travel through the major townships and cities and calling the people to come and present their opinion. And then they put it together, and that is the King Crane report. But the King Crane report got suppressed. And the question is why? And the answer is that not only there was the Paris conference taking place in 1919, where all of this thing was happening, there was also in America, a midterm election had happened in 1918. The ceasefire was in November of 1918 in Europe. That's November 11, if you remember. That's the Remembrance Day that we mark now. But that was the ceasefire, the Armistice Day. Originally, it was the Armistice Day, November 11. But November was also the midterm election in America. And in that midterm election, the Democrat Party, which is the party of President Wilson, lost the Congress, both the House of Representatives and the Senate, to the Republicans. And now, as the Paris Peace Conference proceeded and the treaty was on the table and countries were signing the treaty, 44 country member states, they signed the League Covenant in June of 1919. Well, America couldn't sign it because the Constitution requires the treaty has to be voted in the Senate. A president can negotiate a treaty, but the Senate has to vote upon it. And a two-third majority is required for a treaty to pass. And with a Republican majority, Senator Henry Cabot Lodge, now in the chairman of both the Foreign Relations Committee and the majority leader in the Senate, was not going to go along with the treaty. He was not going to involve the Americans in European affairs. So you might put it in a nutshell, the Democrat president, President Wilson, was engaging with the world and wanted to be engaged with the world. He was the man who was going to bring peace to the world. The Republicans, on the other hand, were following George Washington. Don't get entangled in the affairs of the world, you know? That was his farewell address. Don't be a party with any of the other states in the world or any other organization in the world. You are Americans, you look after America, you know, and the Constitution was set accordingly. So the Republicans denied President Wilson the vote to become a member of the League of Nations and to adopt the League's covenant. So the King Crane Commission, which was basically a commission sent by the League, but led by two Americans because it was nominated by President Woodrow Wilson. When they came back, the report got suppressed. But it was not only suppressed, got suppressed because the Americans no longer was going to be the member of the League of Nations. They were now going to hold that position, which is called an observer status, you know, diplomats going into League meetings as observers, but not as member state. The power was now in the hand of what is called the Executive Council, comprised of the Allied powers at the end of the war. Britain, France, Italy, and America. And suddenly America is no longer there. So it is Britain, France, and Italy. And they decided, it doesn't matter what the people think, we decide. Let me read the quote. In Palestine, we do not propose even to go through the form of consulting the wishes of the present inhabitants of the country, though the American Commission has been going through the form of asking what they are. So that's the reference to the King Crane Commission. The four great powers are committed to Zionism, and Zionism, be it right or wrong, good or bad, is rooted in age-long tradition, in present needs, in future hopes, of far profounder import than the desires and prejudices of the 700,000 Arabs who now inhabit that ancient land. So it was a back-of-a-hand dismissal. We don't care. This is the age of empire. This is
they wanted to be rid of the Jews. They wanted their final solution was Israel. This is my estimation. Here they were given an opportunity because of the mandate in Palestine that England had, or Great Britain had, to parcel out a chunk of land, regardless of what the indigenous people there thought, shift as many Jews out of Europe there as they could because they're Jews, and we don't want them.
I had read that the Arab leaders had instructed the inhabitants of the land, I'm going to call it the Levant, L-E-V-A-N-T, which is how it was known, the Levant meaning the Mediterranean coast. Because if I start there using terms like Israel and Palestine, it might put off people. And those terms, by the way, are historically confusing. So I had read that and I asked my grandmother, is it true that it's the Arab leaders that told you to leave? And she said, yes. She's with the Lord now, but she told me, they told us, you leave here because there's a war coming. We're going to drive the Jews into the sea. And then once we've won that war, you can come back and reclaim the lands that you possess now and also more lands that the Jews possessed. And so my grandmother and my grandfather, by the way, on my mom's dad's family, used to own most of Haifa, including the Mount of the Baha'is. The Baha'i religion owns the mountain now and never compensated us for it. And so they had to leave to Lebanon at the behest of the Arabic leaders, not Jews driving them out. My grandmother tells me that the women would feel safer around Jewish people than around Muslim people. And again, I'm not saying this because I have any kind of agenda against anybody, but when I hear so many infuriating things and lies concerning Israel and concerning Islam, for us Christians of the Middle East living it, it's incredible that a lot of this stuff gets dismissed as mere propaganda, and that people naturally kind of take the pro-Arabic, pro-Muslim side because big bad Israel is oppressing these poor little Palestinians. Hey, you want to stand by? You want to stand by an oppressed minority? I got one for you. The Christians of the Middle East. So I'm going to tell you something that a lot of Christians in the Middle East fear to say, but as long as the Arab Muslim nations are occupied with the state of Israel, we get to live another day. Because if there was no state of Israel, we would be eradicated. We would be next. And guess who would be next after us? You guys, the Christians of the West.
I think the Hamas has abused so many children, they might actually catch up on the Catholic Church at this point. Nobody's safe. What a time to be German. Any Germans here? No. Feels good, right? I bet there's a bunch of Germans going, oh my God, this is so good. This is not our fault. This time, holy shit, this is great. What?
It kind of is our fault, isn't it?
You guys love this shit, huh? You love apologizing. Oh, it's our fault. It's our fault. Everything. Every crisis, it's our fault. We're too powerful. Ah, we could have done something. Ah. It's not your fault. It's not your fault. Those people were murdered. The only people whose fault it is the people that murdered them.
The point of my paper is there is no legal standing of the Balfour Declaration, and yet the Palestine mandate was transformed into implementing the Balfour Declaration. How and why? Well, how is Balfour and his prime minister, Lloyd Douglas, they inserted the Balfour Declaration into Article 22 at the San Remo Conference in April 1920. The San Remo Conference was a conference of the Executive Council comprised of the main powers, Britain, France, Italy, and America. But America was at San Remo only an observer. In San Remo, Britain inserted the Balfour Declaration into Article 22 of the League of Nations, all right? Without any legality, without any vote, without it being presented to the General Assembly, the League Council, all right? And the British ran the British mandate as if it was their territory, not that Britain was a trustee. And so that's the open door immigration into Palestine, while the possibility of the European Jews immigrating to territories outside of Europe, but not to Palestine. Remember, when the Jews of Europe had the opportunity to go to Palestine of their own accord or go elsewhere, they all chose to go to America. The largest number of Jews that left Europe between 1880 and the beginning of World War I was for America. But after World War I, the immigration door was closed. From about 1920 till 1945, the door was closed. The door was again open in the 1960s with the new Immigration Act. These are long and complex issues, but the point is that in Palestine, in 1990, 1920, there were not enough Jews to make a state. And so that's the whole process begins of bringing the Jews in from Europe. And this was done by the British and under British power. And so the question comes out now, what power did Britain have? This was a total scam. It was totally illegal. even though America supported the Balfour Declaration, that is President Wilson, in the period 1920-1945, the doors to America is closed. America did not open the door to the Jews of Europe to come to America. Neither did Canada.
No. Anti-Semitism is historic and rampant. Salim, I think we'll cut it there because this has been a wonderful discussion about an area that interests me, and that is motivation and history and ethics and morality. But at the end of the day, I mean, for the Israelis, it's might makes right, notwithstanding anything that went before. Today, to them, might makes right. I don't know how long that'll last, though. So do you want the last word, Salim, on that particular point, might makes right?
Well, the last point is basically what you mentioned, and I will reiterate. When there is a dispute, or where there is a dispute, there can be no settlement outside of its history, that is the history of the dispute. The settlement has to take place within the context of that history. So the history is the history of Palestine, 1917, to where we are now. It might go on for a few more years, but the settlement will come within the context of that history. And that context is, as I pointed out, a falsehood. And then to protect that falsehood, or to maintain that falsehood and to sustain that falsehood, more and more and more falsehoods were piled upon. And so where we have arrived at is falsehood magnified to the nth degree. And of course, the International Court of Justice unraveling that falsehood, pulling one thread, is going to unravel the whole thing. And that was known from right from the beginning. One person that you did not mention, which is so important in all of this discussion, was the lone Jewish member of the British War Cabinet in 1917, Edwin Montagu. Edwin Montagu was a cabinet member. He was an English Jew. He was the Secretary of State for India at the time in 1917. And he wrote in response to the letter that was being circulated among the members of the cabinet to get the consensus of everyone on board, there was one opposition. And he rejected it completely. And he laid out the argument. He said, Jews are not a nation. Judaism is a religion. It is not a nation. And from there it flowed. So see, again, falsus in uno, everything else was false. And he was concerned about what would be the consequences.
I wonder how many people have ever heard his name. They're out there chanting from the river to the sea. They don't know what river. They don't know what sea. Do they know Montagu? Do they know Balfour? Do they know any of these little snippets of history? Thank you, Salim. This is a wonderful discussion. I understand that it's going to be up to people like you, scholars, historians, history, and the International Court of Justice to decide whether or not the actions of Israel today are beyond the pale. Thank you, Salim.
A settlement will come within the context of a false history, says Salim. And I don't think that he's talking strictly about any decisions made by the international courts or even by the players themselves. It's more like kind of karma. Consider the application of that principle to our own current state of affairs, from COVID to climate change to multiculturalism, all false narratives based on a false history. Anybody feeling the pressure yet? So what is the greater force, sheer might or the continuum of history? Does might make right? Seems to me, from what I've seen throughout my lifetime, is that might makes a heck of a lot of wrong. The use of force, might, exists on both sides of the political polarity and beyond. For example, our listeners, and that's you, might or might not choose to accept our invitation to join us again next week when we will continue our journey in the right direction. Until then, be right, stay right, do right, act right, think right, and be right back here. We'll see you then.
Fade into color, color into black and white.
It's very confusing, you know. It's been 70 years, the Palestinians are still in disbelief. Like, this cannot be real. And the Jews are like, no, this is real. Very confusing.